This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Radio News Hour. On the schedule, it's listed as the Lenman News Hour, but it's the same program. Either way is fine with me. This is our inaugural weekend. Yesterday was the first weekend program, and today is the second. We will be on regularly every Thursday at 10 a.m. Well, let me do it Eastern Time, at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, U.S., and on weekends at 1 p.m. U.S. Standard Time. And as I like to say, make it a regular habit. We'll feature top guests. We'll discuss vital world and national issues. And today, most certainly, is no exception. My guest is Paul Craig Roberts. Paul was Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. He was a Wall Street Journal Associate Editor. He's a holder of numerous academic appointments, including at Georgetown University Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was a fierce critic of Bush administration policies, with good reason, indeed. So am I. And he's just as hard on Obama. And his recent articles, two of them in particular, really make the point. In one of them, he calls the U.S. a police state. Indeed, it is. I don't think that shocks too many people listening to this program, but we'll talk about it. And in another one, he talked about how we're on the road to Armageddon because of the policies that we're pursuing, and indeed we are. So we'll get into these topics and anything more that Paul wishes to talk about. Paul, I welcome you to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, it's great having you back. Shall we talk about the police state first and then the road that they're taking us down? It's pretty serious stuff. If this stuff isn't fixed, heaven help, what's down the road waiting for us? But talk about your police state article.
All right. Well, you know, they used 9/11 to gut the Constitution and civil liberties and all the protections that it gives individuals from the arbitrary and unaccountable power of the government. When they did this, they claimed that it would only apply to terrorists, that is, the denial of the habeas corpus, of due process, of access to lawyers, that none of this would ever apply to American, but it now does. This fellow, Hashmi, is an American citizen, and he's being held in indefinite detention. And apparently he's also been tortured. It's just like everything else they've ever done in the past that they said was only targeted at a specific group. For example, RICO, the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Practices Act, they said that was for the mafia and that no one else's assets would ever be frozen in order to prevent them from being able to hire lawyers to defend them. That this would only happen to the mafia, which just had too much money for the Justice Department to fight, and so their assets would be frozen. Well, almost immediately, it applied to everybody, even to divorce cases. Then they had the asset confiscation of the war on drugs, and they said, oh, this will only confiscate the assets of drug barons. And very quickly, it applies to everybody. There was a very interesting news article just this last week about in Michigan, the police can seize property without any evidence, and they do. They take people's cars and whatever else. So we shouldn't be surprised that the denial of constitutional protection that they told us was only for foreign terrorists is now applicable to Americans. So one aspect of a police state is that the citizens have no protection against the arbitrary power of government. In other words, law is not a shield of the people, as it is under the Constitution, but a weapon in the hands of the government. That is now established in the United States. Hashmi is a good example. The next element of a police state was announced a week or two ago by Dennis Blair, the head of National Intelligence, when he went before the Congress and told the House Intelligence Committee that the U.S. government now has a list of Americans that it intends to assassinate abroad. These are American citizens that it's simply going to murder. In other words, no arrests, no trial, no conviction of a capital crime and execution. We're just going to find them and kill them. So that's the second characteristic of a police state, that the people can simply be shut down by their government without any accountability. So if you take the two together, you have a police state. Now, patriotic-type people, flag wavers and all, will say, oh, but this will only be done to Americans who are a threat. And when you say that, it shows that you really haven't got any comprehension about what the government has told you, because who determines whether the person shot down or thrown in the dungeon is a threat? It's not done by any evidence or court or trial. It's simply done by the assertion of the government, for which no evidence or information is provided. And so people who then trust the government to determine who is a threat on the basis of providing no evidence, they're people who believe that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, that Iran has nukes, and all the other lies and deception that the government tells. So if it will take the country to war based on lies, it will certainly shoot somebody based on a lie, and the people have no way of knowing if the person is a threat or not, because it rests entirely on the government's assertion. And that, then, is the characteristic of a police state. We've seen also recently that high government officials, for example, what is her name, Janet?
Janet Napolitano.
Yes. She has just declared that Homeland Security is shifting its focus from foreign terrorists to domestic extremists. Well, what is an extremist?
Can I interject a comment, Paul? Well, you're homing right in on the central issue. We talk about terrorists. We talk about extremists. We talk about threats to national security. By whose standard, by whose definition, what on earth does this stuff mean?
Right.
In one of your articles.
Before I lose my train of thought.
Okay, go ahead.
So what she's saying is, oh, look, it's not these domestic terrorists we're worried about. Of course, these are the people we were promised would be the only ones that would suffer from these unconstitutional treatments. Now it's domestic extremists. So what is an extremist, and who decides that? An extremist is anybody who criticizes the government. And we see that now with Cass Sunstein, the Harvard lawyer who's in the Obama administration, who wrote the article saying, hey, look, we can't have people questioning what happened on 9/11. That's not allowable. We can't have somebody questioning the government's account of 9/11. And so the way to stop this is to infiltrate all the 9/11 truth organizations with police agents. And then we can provoke them into actions that would discredit them, or into statements that would discredit them, or into actions that we can arrest them. So I think you can see it's coming full circle, that what was allegedly only to apply to these foreign terrorists who are going to kill Americans is now going to be applied to anybody who expresses any criticism of the government, especially criticism that could reveal treason on the part of the government itself. And I'm interested to see that the main case against this Hashmi, this American citizen who's held in indefinite detention, he's not charged, as I understand it, with any act of terrorism or with planning any act of terrorism or any association with terrorism. He is charged and is going to be tried on the basis of tape recordings of speeches he gave as a student at Brooklyn College. Apparently, he was very critical, vehemently critical, of the United States foreign policy. And this is the evidence the government is going to use with some jury to convince them that he's anti-American and needs to be put in prison. So,
Paul, you're talking about Fahad Hashmi.
Yes.
I wrote an article about him some time back. He is, the last I heard, for many months, been locked in isolation in solitary confinement. They are literally trying to break him emotionally.
He's held in indefinite detention without habeas corpus. Right. You're exactly right. They'll probably try to get some kind of confession. But that, again, you see, is illegal under the Constitution. Self-incrimination is not evidence, and judges are required to dismiss all cases in which the evidence is self-incrimination. But already we see they're now accepting it. They're accepting evidence produced by torture. So I think that all this together shows a fairly robust police state that's on a roll and that's growing. The federal judges don't stop it. The Congress doesn't stop it. And if you'll permit me just a few more minutes.
Oh, sure. We just now
had the Patriot Act extended. You know, it was due to expire today, I think, and they've now extended it for another year. Of course, it'll be extended forever, just like the debt ceiling. You know, the debt ceiling was supposed to be a one-year extension, and it's now been going on for decades. Well, in the process of getting the Patriot Act renewed, the Republicans forced the Democrats, not that the Democrats are really any better, but it forced the Democrats to take out the amendments that they had put into the Patriot Act, prohibiting torture. I think it was called cruel, inhuman, and degrading. Interrogation was prohibited by amendments the Democrats had put into the Authorization Act. And the Republicans forced them to take that out, and this shows you the kind of attitude that's prevailing in the Congress. Representative Pete Hoekstra, a Republican, I think from Michigan, he said that this effort to stop the U.S. government from torturing alleged terrorists was outrageous. And he said that the Patriot Act is supposed to be about, quote, defending our nation, not giving greater protection to terrorists. So we've reached the point where if you abide by the Geneva Conventions, which, of course, we created, that prohibit torture, and a U.S. law passed in the 80s that makes torture a felony, if you abide by that, now you are giving greater protection to terrorists. So we can see that despite all the revelations about torture in the various American prisons where these people are held, and the lawsuits about them and all the rest, still we have a Congress that will not do anything to stop this torture, and it gets outraged at the suggestion that somehow we can deal with alleged terrorists without torture, because under the Constitution, any evidence obtained by self-incrimination is impermissible. So that, then, is a long-winded, but it covers the waterfront as to why the United States is a thoroughgoing police state. And
Paul, absolutely. Can I throw a few comments in? I've written a fair amount about this stuff myself. It really is shocking and appalling. Again, regular listeners to my program understand this because these topics come up over and over again, including specific people who have been targeted, bogusly charged, like a Fahad Hashmi. You had the case of Afia Siddiqui in one of your two articles. I think it was the Armageddon one. A shocking case. I had her lawyer on a past program. Her case was the most egregious I ran across, but there are so many others who have been bogusly charged, absolutely maliciously, lawlessly treated. And every single case I wrote about, it was about 25 individual cases, most of them Muslims. From all the facts I could put together, they all were innocent people. They did absolutely nothing. They were used to scare people that there are bad folks out there and your government is on the watch protecting you, rounding up these bad people, putting them away so they can't hurt you. And these are ordinary people, just like you, me, and your next-door neighbor, Paul, illegally being targeted. Our nation that claims to be a democracy and supports the rule of law is absolutely lawless, reckless. All these buzzwords we throw around that have no meaning whatsoever. You raise a very important case in one of your articles. Again, I think the Armageddon one, the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And you make the obvious point. If you beat hell out of somebody long enough, they'll tell you anything you want to hear. The waterboarding was only one part of it. 183 times he was waterboarded, and that was only at Guantanamo, Paul. They did it to him at Bagram in Afghanistan before they ever shipped him to Guantanamo, and they did so much more. I itemized what I could find about the specifics of what they did to this guy. Oh, my God. Again, I mean, you do this to somebody, and again, you'll get them to say what you want, sign anything you want. I don't. And they call him the 9/11 mastermind.
This has been known in.
That he outwitted,
British,
in your words, 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. This guy all by himself. I mean, that's absolutely crazy.
Yes, that's for sure. And, of course, the reason that British, some centuries ago, whose legal system we inherited, banned any evidence in court obtained through torture, simply for the reason that you gave, that you can make people say whatever you want. And I think also we have to understand that the people doing the torture enjoy it. It attracts the worst kind of people who love to be abusive and harm others. You can't get just anybody to torture somebody. It takes a particular type. And so once you have torture as part of your system, which we now do, you're going to have a class of really sadistic people who are undertaking those activities, and they don't care whether the person is innocent or guilty. It doesn't matter to them. They get their jollies from inflicting the abuse. So it leads to further brutalization of the state. It just becomes increasingly brutal, and it spreads into areas that are not directly doing the torture. And so the people lose all protection. You see, right now, the people think, oh, well, this is only happening to people with funny names, those Muslims that have funny names, and really they shouldn't be here anyhow, and this is only for them. And they must be guilty, or the government wouldn't be doing it.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
This, yeah. So this shows an enormous ignorance of 20th century history. Stalin's gulag and Hitler's concentration camps were full of millions of innocent people who hadn't done anything. And so the fact that you're innocent, which is another defense the patriots fall back on. They say, well, I'm not doing anything. They're not going to bother me. But, of course, as you've already pointed out, most of the people they're already bothering haven't done anything either. And that included the Guantanamo detainees. You may remember when Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense for Bush, Dubia, told us that the 760 people in Guantanamo were, quote, the most dangerous men on earth.
The worst of the worst, Paul.
Yeah. And it turned out, what, that already they've released over 500 of them.
Yeah.
And that practically everyone in Guantanamo was some innocent person who was kidnapped or seized by some warlord in Afghanistan in response to the Americans' offer of a bounty for terrorists. So the warlords just seized whoever was unprotected in their area, sold them to the Americans, and that's who was in Guantanamo. And that's why after all those years, after all the torture and abuse and then holding people for years and years, just stealing from their life and military commissions and everything else, that they can't find any to put on trial. It's just, they just weren't dangerous at all. They hadn't done anything to us. I think, you know, they're trying to hold on to, how many is they trying to hold on to? 50 or 100 or?
Preventive detentions, another lawless idea.
Yeah.
You know, Barack Obama, my goodness, change that we can believe in, Paul. Roughly about 50 who will remain uncharged and held indefinitely under protective detention.
Yeah.
Out
of the 760 most dangerous people on earth, the government lies, no matter who's in office, every time it opens its mouth. Now it says, well, only 50 of them are. Well, if that means they were wrong about what percent? Almost all of them, right? So if they were wrong about almost all of them, how are they right about these 50? And why do they have to hold them in indefinite detention? If they know enough to hold them at all, then they have the evidence to bring them to trial. So the whole thing is it is a hoax. What it does, it creates precedent that the government can hold people without bringing charges. And so it's going to happen to everybody. It's just a matter of time before the things that we regard as our legal system, the constitutional protections in it, just simply disappear. They just won't be there. If they're not there for these people, they're not there for Americans. They're not. If it's not there for Hashmi, it's not there for you or me. So Americans are sort of, they're really a naive people, and they think they're the salt of the earth, and that, oh, we're so good, we're the indispensable people, and we wouldn't do anything wrong, and our government is wonderful, and so they're perfectly set up. They're just completely set up to have every right obliterated.
Well, very definitely, Paul. They literally can do it to anyone, and I must say, you certainly potentially are on the list. Maybe more than I am. I describe myself as a minnow. They spy on everyone, so they know about everyone more or less. And here I host a program and I do a lot of writing, so my stuff is out there. It's very easy to spot. So I imagine I'm on some kind of a list, but I'm a small fry. You, on the other hand, you were a very prominent figure publicly in the Reagan administration. So they can look at you and say, my God, this guy is a traitor. I mean, he was one of us at one time, and look what he's doing now. Look what he's saying. Look what he's talking about. Look what he's writing. So they could get very angry at you and decide they want to be very, very nasty. And we both know if they want to come get us and do anything they want with us, they can sure do it, and they can disappear us to any place they want so that nobody ever knows what happened or ever hears from us again if that's what they want to do. It's a very scary situation, and I don't take it lightly. We both know this, the conditions, the situation we're living under, and what bothers us both is the naivete in the country is so great. No matter how many times people are fooled, Paul, and then they find out, oh my God, they lied to us. Saddam doesn't have those weapons that they talked about. They come right back with a new scam, and people jump on it. And 70% of the people in the country think Iran is a threat. Have nuclear weapons. Well, Iran has done nothing to violate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. On the other hand, there are three nuclear outlaws in the world, and you never hear a report about any one of them. Pakistan, India, and our good ally Israel. They are nuclear outlaws. We live in an upside-down world, Paul.
That's right. Fortunately, I'm getting on in years, and I think that they're not ready yet to grab me. They're going to grab Muslims, people with funny names, people that are easy for them to set up in order to create all the precedents they need.
So, well, I can barely hear you.
Oh, well, I don't know what's going wrong with the phone.
Oh, no, I can hear you better now. I can hear you better. You were fading out a little bit.
What I said is I think that they have a way to go before they can grab anyone that doesn't have a funny name. They are starting on the Muslims because the Muslims are the ones who are demonized as a threat. And so they have to create the precedents from how they mistreat people with Muslim names. And when they finish that, then they can come after the rest of us. So
let me add one thing to that, Paul. If they want to disappear us without headlines, I guess it doesn't matter what our name is. And they can sure disappear us if they want. But I agree, Muslims are the designated enemy. And one of my taglines is to say that it's the wrong time to be Muslim in America. Muslims were never treated all that well, but now they are the target of choice. You know, the Soviet Union was the target during the Cold War, and when the Cold War ended, we went nuts. We needed a new enemy. Manuel Noriega in 1989, I mean, he was a piker that he wouldn't do, and we blew a stiff wind blew him over, and then we put him away. But we needed a bigger one, so we got Saddam. But Muslims in general are the target of choice, and those people with funny names are the ones who are targeted. And again, innocent people wrongly charged, wrongly put away, including for acts of charity, Paul. It's really shocking. I've written about so many of them. It's shocking to see who they went after and for what reasons. Oh, I could go on and on, but if we don't find a way to stop this, then where are we going? I mean, we'll get into it in the second half of the program, and we'll pause for a minute or so. And then let's talk about the road to Armageddon, John, because, I see us on that road, too. And, again, that scares me. And we have to figure out some way to get people to react so we can turn this thing around before it's too late.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Talking about U.S. lawlessness, U.S. police state, the road to Armageddon. Paul, about a year and a half or so ago, I wrote an article that I called Torture as Official U.S. Policy. I was astonished to find just an array of, they give them so many names, everything from presidential executive orders to memorandums to various documents to findings. And one of the earliest ones, maybe it was the earliest, on September 17th, 2001, so a week after 9/11, George Bush signed a secret finding empowering the CIA to, in quotes, capture, kill, or interrogate al-Qaeda leaders. Well, of course, the first question is, what is al-Qaeda and what is an al-Qaeda leader? I guess it's whoever we decide falls under that category. And basically, I mean, this was the first of the torture and murder memos that the president, on his own authority, is telling the CIA, you can run around the world murdering people. And as you mentioned, and others too, I mean, if you can kill people you call foreign terrorists or whatever, it's a short leap to murdering U.S. citizens. We're doing it. We're now saying we'll do it overseas. What's the difference between overseas and in downtown Chicago? I don't see the difference. If they want to murder somebody, they don't care where they are. They'll go out and kill them. They'll do anything they want with them. And there's a whole blizzard more of these memos and then justifying torture. And, of course, you get the Patriot Act and all the other things, a series of presidential moves under two categories, either national security or homeland security presidential directives, along with executive orders, and some of them are pretty horrendous. I mean, it just goes contrary to the laws we think we live under. And the Patriot Act annulled about a third of the Bill of Rights, and this goes on and on and on and on. And, again, Obama is doing the same stuff as Bush.
Well, look at this, though. The real question is, how does an executive order overturn a United States legal statute? You might remember what came out of the hearings that Senator Church, I think it was, held back in the 70s with the CIA and the CIA Director Colby when they confessed to all the plots they had of trying to murder Castro and other assassinations. And the Congress passed a law that prohibited any U.S. assassination of anybody. Now, as far as I know, that law is still on the books. I don't know of its repeal. And I don't see how an executive order that Bush or anybody else signs is capable of repealing a United States legal statute. So I've never seen this discussed.
You remember when George Bush declared that he was he granted himself what he called unitary powers, a unitary presidential powers, a unitary executive, I think he called it. In other words, he said, the president is above the law. And you remember the quote?
Yeah, I know you said that, but that's not true in our system. So the question remains how the government is able to legally act on the basis of executive orders that are in contradiction to U.S. federal law without Congress repealing the law. Now, possibly the Patriot Act has provisions in there that repeal previous acts that govern these activities. I suspect it must have. But an executive order can't repeal a United States statute. So the whole question of legality is still present. And then also, of course, most of these anti-terrorism laws, patriotism law, Patriot Act, and so forth, they are unconstitutional on their face. And so even though they are now legal on the books, they're unconstitutional. And I don't quite understand how they can survive, other than through the corruption of the judges, how they can survive a constitutional challenge, because it's clear on the face. And any constitutional lawyer who's not part of the problem understands that these laws are unconstitutional. They contradict the requirements of the Constitution, and we know that any law that does so isn't applicable. Now, it remains applicable until somebody challenges it and gets it overturned on the constitutional basis. So I would have thought we would see far more challenges to these laws and a lot more pressure on the federal judges that seem to go along with the notion that we can pick up people and torture them and rendition them and murder them and so on and so on. I think we have to be as worried about the quality of people that have been appointed to the federal bench as we do about the people elected to presidency and to the House and Senate. And it looks like a failure is occurring there, too, because it's hard to believe that the old so-called liberal Supreme Court would have accepted this. It's just hard to see how a court that came up with Miranda that tried to limit the powers of police, even in legitimate criminal cases, make sure that they weren't abusive and weren't making it easy to bring a case by violating people's rights. That type of Supreme Court, I can't see how it would have stood for what has happened since George W. Bush was elected.
Of course, the court can only rule on a case that is brought before the court. It can't on its own hand down a ruling the way the Congress can pass a law. But so the court will take a case, but anyone could bring a case before the court challenging an executive order, which really is it's not a law, but it's treated like a law. They can be challenged. Acts of Congress can be challenged. Acts of the government, policies of the government can be challenged, and the court will rule on them. The court twice ruled in cases of Guantanamo detainees for the lawyers of the detainees, and in both those cases, I wrote about them, but I forget the names. One of them was a man named Boumediene. But when the court did that, the Congress, the Republican Congress, passed new laws overriding the Supreme Court. So you've got a new law on the book. So somebody has to bring a case before the court challenging that law. I guess this can go on and on, Paul, endlessly. But the court is not.
Well,
exactly.
it can go on, assuming the court doesn't want to be very aggressive about it, and doesn't want to really embarrass the lawmakers. I sometimes think our civil rights organizations, such as the ACLU, spread themselves too thin. Right now, with the United States becoming a police state, it doesn't seem to be the time to be worrying about gay marriage or whether or not there can be Christian symbols publicly displayed at Christmas time. When you have limited resources, those hardly seem to be important issues when the Constitution is being obliterated. And it makes me wonder if even the ACLU realizes how serious this is, that they are still allocating money to advocating for gay marriage and getting Christmas scenes out of public places. It almost shows that no one realizes the threat. And there are, of course, other international organizations, such as Amnesty International, and they do speak up, the Red Cross. But it all seems to be diffused. Amnesty International will spend as much time worrying about the mullahs in Iran as it will about what the United States government is doing. But, of course, if the United States government destroys human liberty, we hardly have to worry about the mullahs in Iran. It looks to me like it's just a general incomprehension of what we face. And, of course, the same destruction of individual liberty is occurring in Great Britain, in the United Kingdom, which is the origin of it. That is the place where civil liberties were created. It was a 900-year struggle. And they seem to have turned their back on it, and they behave as we do increasingly. So, and yet we turn around and denounce China, for example, for human rights violations, while we torture people and hold them in indefinite detention. And nobody ever says, hey, what is this? What kind of hypocrisy is this? You're denouncing China for something that you're doing? The media, of course, we don't have a media. The media was destroyed by Bill Clinton, who signed the bills allowing a few mega companies to monopolize it. So there's really no source of public information other than, a radio program like yours and some internet sites or some foreign news site. That's about it. So I don't see a lot of reasons to be hopeful. And with the point you made earlier that we're clearly targets for the police state, it may not make a whole lot of sense that we speak out about it, because the American people don't seem to be able to catch on, and even if they did, I'm not sure at this point what they could do about it. I think
they can do more than they realize, Paul. I look at things that go on around the world. So many examples, much more courageous people in countries than people out here. People who really put their bodies with their feelings and beliefs, like in Greece, going through a pretty serious economic crisis, and 2 million people, 2 million people go out on the streets protesting austerity measures. You know, I mean, criminal bankers.
Yeah, they'll protest the pocketbook, but what about the civil liberties?
Well, the civil liberties too, and Greece is no peach of a country for strong civil liberties. And as you mentioned, the UK most definitely is not also. You were the tradition of the Magna Carta from the UK. In some respects, the UK can be worse than us, but we're in pretty bad shape. And of course, others are too. China is no peach of a human rights, civil rights state. But I'm not aware of China waging illegal wars of aggression against anybody right now. They get very angry at Tibet, that rightfully is part of China, and Taiwan, that rightfully is part of China. But I don't see them bombing them or doing all kinds of aggressive belligerent acts against them. They're not being sweet and nice and lovely, but they're not doing those things. We complain when they spend a few $1 billion extra for their military. They spend a pittance compared to what we spend in our military. We spend more than all of the nations in the world combined, and we don't have a single enemy. So all this stuff goes on, and the media is a major problem, Paul. I rail about it all the time. No matter the media, when the media gets behind a story, that's what hypes it. That's what gets people to believe the kind of lies that were fed. And two people I admire only in the sense for what they taught us, Paul. Two notorious Nazis, Hermann Goering what's his first name? Goebbels. Joseph Goebbels. Well, Goering explained that you can't convince, I think he used farmers as an example, you can't convince a farmer to leave his family and go to war for you. The only way you can do it is to convince them that your country is under great threat, and we need to defend it against these foreign terrorists or whatever we want to call them. So you get people to literally throw down the plow and go to war because they're scared to death. If they don't do it, their families will be harmed. And then Joseph Goebbels, the idea that the biggest lies are the ones that can most easily be believed. And he didn't have television. He didn't have the Internet. He didn't have all the things we have now. You just tell these big lies, and you keep repeating them over and over and over and over, and people will believe anything you want to tell them. So the media is that megaphone here, especially on TV. And they repeat all the hype about all this scare stuff, and people believe it no matter how many times they were fooled before. Somehow we need to get around that to convince people you are being lied to, and you can't believe a word they say. Whatever they tell you, the opposite is the truth. That's the way to take their reports.
Right. You know, it's kind of funny, isn't it, that in the Soviet Union, despite the total monopoly on the media and all the rest, that people learned to read between the lines, and the good part of the population was not taken in, whereas in the United States, if they see something on Fox News, they think it must be true.
Or CNN.
Or any of the rest of them. So it shows, you know, that the Russian peasant in last century was more sophisticated than the American citizen of the superpower.
Oh, they sure were. I remember reading stuff, Paul, where Russians would see what Pravda had to say on a particular day, and they realized that, my God, I mean, this stuff is garbage, absolute garbage. So the Russians knew what the deal was, but Americans, with all of our ability to get real information, they buy this crap. They absolutely buy this crap.
It's very disheartening. I don't quite know how we keep going.
We have to figure out a way to keep pounding our message. We don't have the big megaphones that the big networks have. TV is the powerful messenger, and we don't have that. We have this program that attracts a fraction of what CNN and the others attract. But we just have to keep pounding, Paul, over and over and over again, and every way that we have, and somehow hope that over time the power of repetition, even in a small way, will enlist more and more numbers of people who will, and I tell people this all the time, we have to be the ones to spread the word to others. We have to understand what's going on, and we have to spread the word to others, because if we don't do that, then they will be empowered. They'll be able to get away with everything they're doing and do a lot more, and it's up to us to stop them. It's the only way we could do it. It's in our hands. It's always that way. All the big changes in history, the history that I know, have always come from ordinary people, the grassroots, and it always begins with a few people. You don't have mass movements. A few dedicated people lit the fire that ended slavery. Civil rights, the same thing. The labor movement, women getting the right to vote. My God, I mean the founders, these glorious people, they didn't think women were competent to vote. And when women finally campaigned to get the vote, it took 100 years.
Some people still don't. But what you're saying is a lot of truth to that, but you have to keep in mind that the American Revolution was done by a handful of so-called founding fathers who had to organize it and push it along. And don't forget, too, that the collapse of the Soviet Union did not result from a popular movement. It resulted because the very top of the Communist Party lost confidence in what they had stood for, and they abandoned their beliefs. Their beliefs were shattered by the results. In other words, when they look back at the Stalinist era, which Khrushchev had shattered when he denounced it in a secret speech, and saw that everyone was threatened under that regime, including the highest members of the party. The heroes of the Bolshevik Revolution were all executed. That's like us having executed the founding fathers. And then they looked at the economic results of their way of managing an economy, and they realized that they'd been wrong, that the system was not serving anyone's interest but a very tiny number of top rulers. And they simply lost confidence, and I think that's why that collapse, it failed. So they don't. Sometimes things can happen if they're... It from the top. It can happen from the top. Now, I don't think here it will anytime soon, because they're on a roll and they're power mad, and they are enjoying all the power they're gaining over Congress. You know, this theory you were speaking of earlier, unitary effective, that comes from the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is a collection of Republican attorneys who are the people that are the rank? Those are the ranks that the Republicans use to nominate federal judges and Department of Justice officials and staff to the Judiciary Committees in the House and Senate. That whole idea is coming from them, and that's the idea that the president really is more important than the Congress or the courts. And this comes from, it's like the generals always fighting the last war. This sort of emphasis that the Federalist Society pushes comes from decades ago, when it was thought that the Republicans had a permanent lock on the presidency, but the Democrats had a permanent lock on Congress. And so the Republicans were frustrated that even though they could elect the president, they couldn't get anything done. And so part of getting things done, that is, serving their agenda, was to elevate the power of the president above the Congress so that they could get something done despite the Congress. So that's how that originated decades ago. Well, see, today how it plays out is it helps to create a dictatorship. It wasn't its original intention, but that's the way it's working out, the separation of powers, the equivalence of the three branches. This is the this is being set aside by this slow working of the unitary executive theory. So a lot of things happen that aren't intended or aren't even realized based on old battles fought for reasons that are no longer even present. You can find today a lot of people of my generation who are still fighting the Vietnam War, who are still mad about Berkeley protesters in the 60s, and they're still angry about hippies. And their response to current events is essentially colored so heavily by that that they just get mad at any critic of the United States because, oh, it's them damn anti-war protesters. From the, they see they're still fighting the Vietnam War. And that type of mentality is just not reachable by evidence. You can't say, well, look, it's different. Oh, no, it's not. It's just those damn anti. They caused us to lose in Vietnam, and we can't let them cause us to lose in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever. Or, and they're still mad that we lost the Vietnam War, and they want to get even. And those people will die off. And when they are, that part of the support for the government's police state, it just goes with them.
Right. Paul, we're just about out of time, coming up to the top of the hour. We are very definitely on the same page on this, and in my late years, I'm in my mid-70s, I decided this is the way I want to spend my retirement. I can only reach a small number of people, but like you, I see the urgency to do it so great because of where we're going. If somehow we can't figure out a way to turn this around, then the end of the road that we're both looking at is an extremely ugly end. I see it as black as night, despotism, pure despotism. And I don't think anybody wants a country to live in that's like that. But that's where we're going. It gets worse all the time. So please don't stop what you're doing. And I don't intend to stop what I'm doing. And if we can get a lot more people involved and joining the many who feel this way, then we can spread the word even more and alert people and maybe have a chance that we won't have if we don't keep doing this kind of things. So I'm committed.
Amen.
Oh, we're out of time. Top of the hour. They have another program coming on. Paul, my great thanks for coming on. I hope we can do this again.
Yes, thanks for sharing your audience.
Thank you very much, Paul. And join us next Thursday. Make it a regular habit. And on weekends, of course. And all programs are archived. You can listen live. You can listen later. Any way you like. But above all, listen.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.